Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the CollectingCars.com podcast with Chris Harris and Edward Lovett.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Collecting Cars podcast. I'm sitting today with, as usual, Edward Lovett, that's Ad Edward Lovett, and a gentleman called Sam Fain, who is better known as Seen Through Glass. Now, Sam, can you please deliver your Instagram handle, YouTube channel name, and your Twitter handle, because I can't remember them all.
The lucky thing is it's Seen Through Glass everywhere.
Is it?
So yeah, oh, actually, I think Twitter might be a bit... I think it's like Avril Lavigne back in the day. I spell through just T-H-R-U, but...
Very street.
Yeah, very street. So, it's because I'm young.
But no one's nipped in there because of your newfound fame and nicked the names and made you underscore and capitalise.
You flatter me by saying fame. I think it's not quite that.
Well, I thought that was your surname, sorry. Yeah,
no. No, he's changed his surname to fame.
Yeah, to fame, exactly. But no, luckily enough, I got in with all the handles before I actually even started uploading content, so I had that in place.
Well, look, thank you for coming in today. I've had a few people send me notes saying, get an influencer on. So I thought it'd be a great idea to get Sam here because I think what he's done with his career path is really interesting because he started out as an influencer, and we're going to have some great discussions about what that even means because I'm still not sure I know. And then we'll talk about where he's ended up, which his career path appears to have led him to homelessness and then driving an arse engine sports car around the world. But let's begin, first of all, with a little lubricant to the conversation, talking about what we've done in the last week because it's always a good idea. Edward, what have you done in the last week other than buy and sell cars?
Oh, well, I've tried to buy and sell a few cars. I've been on Daddy Daycare, and I've been running around trying to find cars to consign to our platform, Chris. How much plugging can I do?
You can do a fair amount, given it's your podcast, mate.
Well, yeah, that is the main job at the moment, is finding consignments for collecting cars.
So what I need to do is buy a Daytona so I can buy those wheels.
Fine, we can sort that out. There's plenty of Daytonas.
Have you driven a Daytona?
I have driven a Daytona. Pretty.
No, I mean, I know someone that owns a Daytona. Matthew, I know you're probably listening to this. And what I'm going to say now is going to upset you. I think the Daytona is the ultimate example of a vehicle that's great to look at, and I struggle with the steering. Because the steering is just so heavy. I mean...
I've never driven one.
Once you get going, they're fine. In the car park, they're not great. Yeah. There's quite a few people that fit power steering to them.
Because that comes from the old GTC, doesn't it?
Yeah. But Joe Macari now sort of hot rods a Daytona.
Yeah,
bit more power, and Marino's driven it, and I think they love it, and I think Dario's got a chopped Daytona coupe, hasn't
and that's got some of the bits, has it?
Correct. So lowered, widened, hot, and I remember a few years ago, I think I was with my wife actually at the time, and we were driving through
your wife. A different wife? Or
the same one.
Okay.
Well picked up.
Anyway, we were driving through London in a LaFerrari, as you do.
This is a very casual story, isn't it?
No, we were on our way to the RM auction.
This podcast is for the people.
Exactly. We were on our way to the RM auction in Battersea, and I followed Joe Macari in one of his proper Daytona Spiders, a beautiful green car. And I couldn't keep up with him in the LaFerrari. He knows how to drive. And I did almost throw the LaFerrari into a roundabout in Battersea, I think.
Why do all of his car stories always involve I nearly...
Well, so quite a few of them end up in I did. But the I nearly ones are okay because it means I survived.
I'm noticing a theme, though. Every time that you guys talk about collecting cars, Chris, you're always mentioning wheels. I feel like that's your obsession.
Yeah, I do. I'm so done with modern alloy wheel design. I think they've become too big in terms of diameter, and there's no longer a dish. For me, I love a dished wheel. I think they look fantastic, and I think they're the wheels of my youth. So you'd see cars that were widened and sportified, and the telltale was they had a dished wheel, a normal design, but the rim would come out by way of having the spokes staying where they were. And I don't like these wheels that are the spokes are right on the outer edges. So you just turned up in this Jaguar, what are they called? Project 8.
Yeah, XC Project 8.
And
you complimented those wheels.
They don't look too bad, but they still have the spoke that comes right out to the rim, and I don't like the way they look. So
you don't have to buy a Daytona competition.
Well, just buy the wheels.
Or an M Coupe.
Yeah, the M Coupe's nice, isn't it? And again, a dished wheel. Yeah. That's a great example of a car that had a massively dished rear wheel. It looked fantastic. Of course, the problem is, a dished wheel, you need a lot of volume of metal on the edge to maintain the strength. Therefore, they become very heavy. Yeah. So these current designs, when they're made of mag and beautiful alloys, are lighter and better. But they still look a bit pants, if you ask me. So
I'm not going to allow this podcast to become about me and my career. However, I did start my career cleaning cars, as you well know, at BMW in Bristol. And the most pleasurable wheel to clean was an M Coupe wheel.
Yeah, because you
get your whole hand in there.
Yeah.
Taking your bag anyway,
taken out of context, yeah. That would be a really odd thing to say. Well, we've digressed from your last week. We've had enough of you. So what have you been up to?
I went to New York for the final Formula E race of the year. I mean, I don't know if it's a controversial topic in this group, Formula E, but I'm going to come out and say it. I like it. As an event to attend. I think it's awful on TV. I don't think it works on TV, but as an event to attend, I like it. And
isn't that a slight problem for a sport?
Massive.
Maybe it doesn't
problem.
Translate into television.
Yeah, I think disaster for them.
The inherent. I mean, I could go on about Formula E for a while, and we'll try not to.
Sure.
But the inherent problem with all motorsport is that any car that looks like it's going quick in real life, once you put it through the frame rate they use on television, never looks quick. I mean, look, you watch a Formula One car going through Beckett's Maggots when you're there. It is defying the laws of physics, but on telly it looks like it's normal speed. And then if you see a Porsche Carrera Cup race car go through there, you think, oh, come on, get on with it. It looks rubbish. And the Formula E, it looks like they're driving in sand.
They look like golf buggies, which is obviously an analogy they're trying to avoid.
Why they design the tracks for them to drive on that are about as wide as a car and a half?
Because when the background's closer to the cars, the scenery, it makes them look quicker. But also, they're not going very quick, and therefore street circuits are safe.
I thought they designed these tracks so you could literally not get two cars down there. But obviously they try because they're racing drivers.
They try,
all knock each other off.
And that means there's always crashes. That's what I mean. It's sort of obviously it's not the greatest motorsport for true sort of petrol heads. But as a day out event, and especially as a family friendly motorsport in inverted commas event, it's just so accessible. And it's one day you turn up, you follow the action throughout the day. It builds and builds in hype. There's always no one that is never a processional race in Formula E, say good things or bad things about that.
It's obviously saving the planet as well. The guests can, like Sam, can fly on a jumbo jet over to New York to watch it for a day.
What was the carbon footprint of the Audi UK guest contingent flying, turning left on the bomber to go and watch a Formula E race?
I drove an i8 to the race, if that helps.
You drove an i8 as a guest of Audi?
I was there with BMW. Which was great because it meant that they were really competitive for the weekend, which is also exciting because they've had dodgy season. But I do genuinely enjoy it.
I like anything that's nascent, you have to give it a chance to establish itself. There's no doubt that electricity is the future of motorsport because that's where car manufacturers are having to go. And I think it would be remarkable if Formula One wasn't more or entirely electric within 7-8 years, yeah. Which makes me shudder a bit.
That depresses me massively.
Do they have the Jaguar I-Pace racing series?
They do,
it?
Which is even worse. I mean, that is really atrocious.
That is out of the bottom drawer.
Yeah, I mean, I think I know someone who drove one of those and just said it was appalling on every level, and I think it looks appalling.
And it's $650,000 dollars arrive and drive, so you could go and do Blancpain or. Or you could basically drive around in an SUV.
Around a pretty dodgy circle.
So, but you have to start somewhere, okay? So I understand that. What about driving? What have you driven in the last week? Talk me about this. Talk me about the Project 8.
The Project 8. I guess I'm obsessed with this car.
Turned up in the Chevalier this morning.
It is.
It's not the Chevalier. Don't you dare. I don't have to agree that the stickers are a little bit strange.
I mean, you do present something of a paradox. Because you turn up and you expect basically a gun-toting limited to get out, and you get out and go, oh, good morning.
Hello, how are you? So nice to be here in Chelsea. Or Fulham, sorry. Basically, this is a car. It's a Jaguar Special Vehicle Operations car, so it's a loan car or press car, however you might say it. But I'm a Jaguar obsessive. I owned an F-Type R for a year or so, as us YouTubers do. That's long for a YouTuber. And loved it. It was brilliant, and I kind of miss it. And so when they launched this Project 8, or I heard that they were going to launch it, I really thought I wanted one. I thought it was going to tick all my boxes.
And then you saw the price.
And then I saw the price. And actually, I went to one of those sort of, you know, potential purchaser previews. And I was sitting there with a friend, and he said, how much do you think it's going to be? And I read the press release, and the last line was, the Project 8 will be priced for collectors. And I went, oh. I said, it's going to be $150,000. He said, if it's $150,000, I'll laugh and I'll walk out of the room. They do the whole presentation, and at the end they go, the car will be £1,409,995. And he laughed and walked out of the room. And probably the rest of us should at the same time, because it's too expensive. But I love it. So I've been driving it. I picked it up. I got it 2 days ago.
It's a lunatic car. And I think it was in principle it's a good idea, because the numbers didn't stack up for Jag to go and make a proper 3 Series, was it a proper M3 rival? And they would have struggled in the marketplace because the Germans really have a monopoly in that area. So they still needed a halo car, brand builder. They needed something to follow Project 7. It all made sense. The two main problems are, one, the Germans are so good. Because I'm pretty sure stock E63S on sticky tyres would take care of that thing around the track. Jag won't want to hear that, but if you've driven
an E63... It's got a Nürburgring lap record, don't forget.
Yeah, but if you stick a set of moody Michelins on pretty much anything, it'll do it. So, I just think it just looked too bad boy for what people wanted. And so, funnily enough, clearly they've struggled to shift a few units because they announced the race series to get, and then they just announced this one without the wings. I saw the picture of them without the wings, and I thought, I might have a go.
Does
at
it
that.
Look all right?
Well, it had that Black Series Mercedes AMG look to it, where there's this suggestion of naughtiness, but not just the full peacock plumage, which I think is what appeals to people for a road car.
I think the suggestion's pretty brutal, though. I mean, when you walk up to that car, you see it parked, especially here in London, it looks like a race car parked on the road. I mean,
in all fairness, though, even that car downstairs with the wings on it, if it wasn't in that blue and it didn't have a Jaguar rear wheel arch,
the moment you've got stanchions, whatever you call them, stanchions, the moment you've got posts that attach a wing to them, you either look like you should be at a track, or you're trying to be at a track, or you're just a knob.
Yeah.
And
side skirts.
And for some reason, GT3 RS gets away with it because it's the beginning end of that story. Whereas that just looks like you're trying too hard. But without the wings,
there's potential.
I'll give you. But then you've paid big dollar for it, and you sit inside and go, you've got the classic Jaguar Land Rover infotainment system, which frankly has a mind of its own. It's unfathomable. So it was a bit of a missed opportunity for me.
And there's too many things wrong with it, because I would say the closest on-road experience I've had in terms of how it feels behind the wheel is a GT3 RS, because it feels that sort of solid and planted into the tarmac and just track focus, basically. But the GT3 RS is basically perfect in every way, right? Seating position and comfort.
It's also got 350 kilograms less to lump around, which is everything on a track.
Which is exactly that. And then the Project 8, you're sitting in a slightly weird offset position, and it's left-hand drive only because
you're talking yourself out of it, mate. 5 minutes ago, you were.
It's because I don't have the money. I'm not Shmi 150. I know that's what you wanted on this podcast.
It was a religious experience, but now. Yeah. So I and also it's a, it, I quite like the idea of of deliberately absurd performance cars. You take something that shouldn't have performance and give it performance. I can remember when I was a kid, there was an American truck called a GMC Cyclone. I remember seeing it in car magazine. It was like an American little pickup, and someone gave it 300 horsepower or something. And just this concept of something that should go really fast, shouldn't go really fast, but does, is great. But the Project 80 is the ultimate example of a vehicle that answers a question that was never asked, which is, I've got 150 grand to spend. I want to go and do track days, but I want it to have four doors and no rear seats. Whatever, you know, that one's got rear seats, hasn't it?
That one's got rear seats.
Hold on. The best one is the one. I just sat in the back seat of it. Yes. So
it's early. We'll forgive you. Yeah. But you're right. You can have the ridiculous track pack version for an extra 10 grand. Here we go. Me and my Jag salesman. With a roll cage. You lose the back seats, which makes it even more ridiculous. But what was the M4 one that they did? Was it a DTM that didn't sell
they did
as well?
They did a DTM, but they also did a GT. Yes, didn't they? Yeah. They've done a few.
Which would you have then? I mean, because
I was really underwhelmed by that car. Yeah. So we had it for some test against the GT3 RS and another track focused thingy. I don't know what it would have been. Oh, it would have been an AMG GTR, which is a good car. And the BMW just got absolutely mullered because the motor doesn't quite stack up at that price level. It's not that.
But they
fast.
Look wrong as well. You know, what was the CSL was a pure thing, an object to look at. Where the later versions,
the E92, whatever it would have, the
GTS, the GTS, orange one.
That was a massively overpriced nonsense. But if you drive one now, it's quite cool.
Mm.
But I agree. Sadly. Going into that marketplace is a bit like trying to build a very expensive GT convertible back in the 90s and noughties. You know, Mercedes SL bossed it. And the number of companies, I remember talking to their marketing people, they go, we've been thinking of doing a car in that class, but we know that people just want an SL, so there's no point in us going there. And I slightly get that feeling of the way Porsche monopolizes. Every now and again, someone else comes in to make a splash because their marketing department says, we should go in there, we can do it. And they normally leave 3 years later with very red bottom cheeks and their tail between their legs. Yeah. So, okay, so you've been doing that. In the last week, I've been knocking about in this ratty M5 I've bought, which I'm slightly evangelical about, but I got stuck in a traffic jam on a motorway and it has no aircon. So I've now understood that I might need to find some bits on eBay to fit aircon to it. I went out on a speedboat last night on the River Severn, which I've never done before. I've lived in around that area for many years, and driving of going underneath the bridge and seeing that as a piece of engineering, I found fascinating. I just thought it was amazing. Also, what an angry piece of water! If you turn the engine off, you're about a mile away from where you were within seconds. I mean, if you fell in there, it would be
it is very tidal,
properly dangerous. I also now know that when you go from Chepstow up the Wye, there are some high-sided gorges there, and if you speak quite quietly, it echoes quite a lot. So if you fall in and you swear, then people hear you.
Good to know.
People that are walking. So I had a few complaints about my language.
What's the wave you can catch?
That's the seven ball.
The seven ball.
That you can surf all the way
a
up.
A singular wave? Or
one wave that comes in on the Neap or the Springtide, one or two. Comes all the way in. You can surf it for 5 miles or something.
Yeah, that is brilliant. Yeah. If I could surf, that
you can boogie board.
In terms of new cars, I'm slightly out of the loop at the moment with the old new car. What have I driven? Oh, I rolled my old. I got a Mulsanne, which is a bit
of
a.
I rolled it out.
I've been in that for a couple of days. I love that car. There's something about a big old smoker. And I look absurd driving it because I'm small and I'm brown. So it looks like there's a tall white guy should be in the back being driven by me. But no, it's actually me. I should have a sign on the front going, it's just me on my own.
I remember...
It's funny. You just said, we've just talked about the car downstairs, these big, very expensive cars that have no use, we think. But they probably do to some people. But you are now talking about a very expensive, although half the price it was new Bentley.
But it's for me, it serves a purpose. It's very comfortable. It was the result of a classic piece of whiskey-fueled man-math internet searching where I went on to buy. I do a lot of miles to go about the place, and I'm getting old and tired, and I just wanted something to take up the miles. So I went on to buy a Mercedes S-Class, a used S-Class. I thought, I'll get a used S-Class, do loads of miles in it, it'll be fine. And as ever, that started. And by the time the second whiskey, third whiskey gone down, I've ended up buying a Mulsanne. Because you go through it and think, well, if that's that month, do a calculation. Someone's trying to desperately flog a Mulsanne. You think, I'll get a deal on that. And by the end, I bought them. So many times this has been my downfall. And I'm a sucker for what I view as man-math value. So if you go to Crewe and watch someone, watch them make a Mulsanne, it's so labour intensive. It takes nearly three times longer than a normal Bentus, right? So it's, you know, there's a lovely old woman there that takes the, goes into the humidor and gets the veneers out, and the thing is properly hand built. And then you think, how many man hours have gone into this thing? How much love and attention has gone into it? It's an object of pure luxury and indulgence. And then you speak to someone and they say, we've got one, it was new 3 years ago, it was £300,000. It's done 13,000 miles and you can have it for, I think it was 80,000. I know this is absurd, but that's value, isn't it? So you it's worth less than a third of its new price. And I can't help that.
Yeah.
I think we can all argue ourselves into any car, realistically. Yeah,
but it's not 80 grand, is it? Because I've put it on the tick, so I think I'm 15 in, and I have some drip every month. And
how many miles has it done?
It had done, I think, 13. It's already done 22.
Wow. Oh, so it was a proper car.
Oh, it's gorgeous. It's absolutely
not like a ratty Phantom with 100,000 miles.
I remember seeing you at Silverstone. I went quiet on that.
Yeah. I had a bad time with that. So the steering rack failed, and that needed doing, and then it needed a service. And then, I mean, the bills. There was one bill that came in, and I genuinely phoned them up and said, "I think you've made a mistake. There's an extra naught on it," because I couldn't get my head around what they were doing. Oh. And then the fuel pump failed, and they wouldn't replace only one. They said, as a matter of course, we have to replace two. So I looked at the spec of the engine and thought, it's just a 760 engine. This, it is genuinely the BMW engine. So I looked at the part number, and it's three times the price for the Rolls-Royce one. Wow. Over the BMW one. I said, well, I'll just buy a couple of BMW ones, boys. Slap those in. Sorry, sir. We can't do that. At that point, I thought, she has to go.
Yeah.
There are a few cars that when they come out, I look at them and thinking, I don't want to own one today, but I'm thinking about you in the future. And the new Bentley Flying Spur does that to me. That looks
very nice,
brilliant. And as I said when we were coming upstairs, the AMR Rapide, which I appreciate you don't like the shape.
No, it's just the shape.
After driving a normal Rapide S, it's a wonderful car.
Do you have any contacts with Aston Martin in the trade or not?
Not anymore, no.
So I've been enjoying. And the weird thing about, okay, it's very difficult to talk objectively about a car like that because I know it comes across as me being absurd, but I'm mid-40s. I've worked reasonably hard. I don't feel guilty about buying a used
Bentley.
You're
mid-40s?
Bentley. Yeah, I'm a very old man. And therefore, what I do like is the motor vehicle is, I think, very appealing on many levels. But one thing that people underestimate is the fact that you're hermetically sealed from the outside world and it's your little space. And it's a bad thing. We've become addicted to it because that's why we all drive around on our own in cars, which is a massive issue. But when you're in that Bentley, you are genuinely sealed from the outside world. And it calms me down. I don't drive it fast. I just schlep everywhere. I listen to the radio. I listen to audiobooks. It changes my entire behavior and my outlook on life. I turn up after a three-hour journey in that. And I smile. People think I'm ill when I get out of it because normally I scowl and I'm rude. But people get out and go, "You're right. Mm. You seem to be happy."
Yeah, but doing what we do, or what all of us do, we do have to do a lot of miles.
Yeah.
And I think anyone outside of that does think we're mad often. You know, you say, "I got a four-hour drive up somewhere," and they go, "Oh my god, I can't." You're like, "I'm quite looking forward to it."
Exactly.
It's thinking time.
I love the driving and I love the thinking time. But there's something about being a big old bus that's quiet that calms you down because sometimes you do grow a pair of horns. And, you know, you want to push on. You never really want to push on in the Bentley because that means stopping. And it's like a tanker. You try a big stop. I had a blue one. Bentley lent me one when I was racing a Bentley a few years ago. And I had it for a while. And I went, I took Maz from Singer to, we did our first
I
interviews.
Remember this story.
We did our first interviews we're doing a film documenting the entire process of that new Singer, which is going to be really cool.
Nice.
And we went to Stuttgart to interview a couple of famous engineers from Porsche. And we had to get there in a bit of a hurry and it was in a Mulsanne speed. And the bad boy would sit at a 175 to 180, would sit there at a cruise and you could just talk at this level. It was so well engineered and you could tell that they'd done real testing on it. However, I had to do one massive stop to get out of the way of a truck and it had ceramics on it. and they basically caught, they were on fire.
Literally caught fire.
Yeah, yeah, they were on fire. Best of them.
Oh,
and so,
I think you showed us a photo of that, didn't you?
And there's the Speedo needles. It's all cocked up, isn't it? But the Speedo, it feels like it's wound itself off the clock.
But the thing is, when you want something that big, you don't really know anything's on fire because it's so quiet and you're so sort of cocooned that you don't really catch on.
Well, it comes through the nose.
Okay. That's your first
The olfactory senses. You go, oh, shit. But no, and I love the way the Mulsanne looks. There's just this Art Deco beauty to it and I'm slightly addicted to it. I think it's not a 2-year project for me. It's probably 18 months, and then I'll have to move it on because the depreciation. I mean, who puts miles on a Mulsanne? When I get that bid on the way back, it's going to be the old days with Edward. Edward, what's it worth? I've got some bad news. Chris, I've got some bad news. You know, the market's changed terribly
in 2 days. I can't believe it.
Now there was something else you've done this week.
What's that?
You've built a Tamiya.
Oh yeah, I've been doing that. So because of the unique way the BBC is funded, I can't take sponsorship. But I've had Tamiya on my crash helmet for a couple of years now, 3 years, and I have a couple of model kits from them. So they are, if you're a child of the 80s, a Japanese company called Tamiya made these model kits, radio controlled cars. So you'd build it yourself. And you'd get it on Christmas Day, and normally you'd fight to get it done by Boxing Day, and then normally you'd smash it in half against a tree halfway through Boxing Day and be clawing at your parents saying, can I have a new chassis, please? And they were just, for me, they were an incredibly important part of my youth because they taught me about how a car worked. My limited understanding of suspension, differentials, everything else, even the internals of a damper, were defined by these model kits. And so, as ever, wanting to live vicariously through my children, I've given them the model kits. And I sat down with my eldest son this week and spent 2 days just building a Tamiya model
kit. Not letting him touch anything.
No, I'm not that bad. I mean, he'll tell you that I was a bit bossy at times. But do you know what? And on a serious note, in a world of social media, of children with their heads down looking at devices and not acknowledging people when they walk into a room, what a joyous thing to do. We put our phones to one side and we sat and argued and laughed, drank tea, and I sat there going, and that you'll find is a fully independent rear suspension. and look at that universal joint.
What was your first Tamiya?
My first Tamiya was an Audi Quattro.
Was it?
Yeah, what was yours?
Mine was not as tasteful as that. I had to Google it just to make sure it was a Tamiya. I'm pretty sure it was. I got the lunchbox.
Did you?
Yeah. I'm not sure you'd be able to call something the lunchbox today
manner.
Yeah, the lunchbox. But the lunchbox had a fixed rear end as well on it, didn't it? It had a solid rear axle.
It did. It was cool. I remember building it, as you said, and the first time I used it, took it out into the field, and the throttle got stuck, and it disappeared.
It was gone.
Yeah, it was
never coming back.
The big worry was if it got out of range and the speed controller was on full speed, you couldn't then knock the throttle back. It just went off and destroyed itself. So yeah, I built one of those. I love Tamiya. In fact, every time I go to Japan, I do go and find the Tamiya shop and just walk around and buy books and rare sort of glues and things they only sell in Tamiya Japan. It's a bit of a cult, actually. It's a bit like Arai helmets. It's one of these things that became a global phenomenon. But when you go back to base, it's tiny. I went to the Arai headquarters a year ago, and it really is. It's in the equivalent of an industrial estate in Swindon. Yeah. You expect this.
It's not interesting, really, at all.
Well, no, it was amazingly interesting, but I just love the fact that they don't get beyond themselves. But their view is, we make crash helmets. We're not an international corporation, so we're not going to change. And you go in, and Mr. Arai walks in and goes, do you want a coffee? And you go, and the foyer, they've got a display of all their stuff in the foyer. It is less impressive in terms of its scale and the way that it's been arranged than the merchandising side of a BMW dealership.
Yeah.
But they love it. They're so, you go in there and there's a lid that's been, there's Jensen Button, there's some of the best drivers in history have signed all this gear, and it's just like it's in someone's living room. I love it. It's understated brilliance. Right.
Well, whilst we're on cars, just a couple of things I want to talk about before we get into
this is
the world.
You don't normally do this.
No, I don't. Because
Which vehicle of yours value do you want us to increase
there's
just now?
Because you just said earlier on that there's quite a lot's happened in the last 48 hours or so in the car world. I want the opinion on electric hypercars that for some reason need to be 2 million quid.
Yeah. Mm.
And on the other contrast is an iconic American muscle car that's $60,000.
Start on this.
Oh, God. Well, as a man who I don't think will ever be buying a car for £2 million, I couldn't care less about ones that are priced that highly. I mean, I think forever now, it seems to be that there are these companies and manufacturers, whether they're huge companies or independents, that are releasing cars for the very few, whether it's Koenigsegg or limited edition Paganis or Lotus with this new electric.
It's called the Evija.
Evija, there we go. Thank you. It sounds like a form of thrush.
It looks like most of these.
I think it looks like a
sports
Ferrari.
Cars. Well, it just looks like a sports car. But Lotus build lightweight, affordable.
Well, I think we have to accept the fact that there's a new Lotus now, and under Geely, I suspect they're going to emerge because Geely's custodianship of Volvo is the most successful of those relationships. I've followed that quite closely actually from the start, and they've done an amazing job. They've gone there. Everyone thought they were just going to sort of asset grab and take the badge over to China and make crap cars in China. But actually what they've done is they've capitalised a great brand and said, go and do your thing. And Volvo are now making knockout cars that look fantastic and are very desirable.
XC40 is like my dream everyday car. Yeah. I'm obsessed with that little thing.
And I think they've done a great job. So one has to say, looking at that template, they have every chance of doing it with Lotus. Although Lotus is, you know, it is the poison chalice, isn't it? Mm. So many people in the last 25 years, 30 years, have tried to resurrect Lotus and failed. So it is the graveyard of ambition in some respects. But one has to think that Geely can succeed. But the 2000... Now, do you relaunch Lotus as a brand with a car that no one can afford? I think it's a bit tricky, that one, because there's... Unobtainium is a great way of haloing a brand.
That is your favourite word.
I do,
it?
Yeah.
He's used it twice this morning.
But stuff that most people can't afford and should remain on a poster is weirdly tangible. But if you go to the sort of outer stratosphere and start talking about £2 million, I think people lose interest. Also, there is something inherently unsexy about these electric powertrains because no one really knows what they're about. And I don't think anyone knows they're real, because we all know the Rimac can lunch anything in a straight line, but I've not seen, you know, I've not seen many people just get in one and slide the shit out of it on a circuit. But I'm sure it'll happen. So, jury's out. I think it's an odd strategy. Yeah. I hate to endorse Mr. Baja, who obviously went to Lotus with 7 ridiculous cars that didn't exist, and this is what we're doing. But there's a middle ground. I would have hoped they'd have gone, here's the Evija, and by the way, here's a mock-up of our new £55,000 or £60,000 sub Cayman rival that's going to be 250 horsepower, maybe a light hybrid or a very, very efficient petrol engine, and it's going to weigh 850 kilograms. It's basically, they need an Alpine A110.
That's exactly right. And funny enough, I was reading something on Twitter this morning about the new Corvette, and this is typical of American cars because they are very cheap in America. When you bring them over here and add VAT and import duty and convert them to right-hand drive, you know, they aren't as cheap anymore. But the statement they made in this tweet was that's going to be right in there amongst Alpines and Caymans, which is exactly what Lotus should be, you know, should I get an Alpine?
But if you're looking at if you're Geely and you've just recapitalized Lotus and you need to make money, I mean, you just look at margin, don't you? And that was the great problem for Lotus. I love Lotus. I had a very early Elise. I had a very early Exige. But the margin on I'm led to believe the margin on an early Elise was, you know, a grand if they were lucky. Mm-hmm. If you're selling a sports car for 50 grand, where's the margin? Whereas if you're selling a car for 500,000, you can wriggle in a big old margin. So someone clever with a spreadsheet and a big forehead will do those numbers. But yeah,
there was something fundamentally wrong, by the way, with the Series 1 Elise and how it handled on a wet racetrack.
No, it was just a bit spiky, that's all.
Not the one I had.
Yeah, the rear toe could go out, and that original tyre was Larry. But, you know.
Apart from that, hey.
I mean, I only crashed mine once. I stacked my Elise. I did as well. That wasn't a fine day. It wasn't mine.
We move to the Americas, though, I went to the launch event or party, I don't know what they would call it, for that Evija thing.
And I think that part of your global contract as an influencer?
Yes, thank you. And their claim is that this car, you know, Lotus have always been front runners. They've always done stuff that's a little bit controversial or headline grabbing, and that's what they're trying to do with the Avijo. It's trying to say, look, we're different, we're revolutionary, we can bring, you know, new stuff to the market.
What, and you listen to that bullshit?
Well, no, because I was on Instagram and Twitter at the time.
Let's be absolutely clear. Everyone at the moment is thrashing around going, what's going to happen? What's the future? Let's hedge our bets. Let's say that we've got a 2,000 horsepower concept electric hypercar coming. So it's not in any way breaking the mold. Everyone's doing it, I think, at the moment. But they're not tangible, these things, until I know what they're about. Also, I've got a 300 horsepower 25-year-old estate car at the moment, and I can't deploy all of that on the road. So what, I don't know what I'd do with 2,000. Anyhow, let's move on to the Corvette.
Yes.
I was a bit worried by the way the camoed mule cars look, because they didn't seem to sit too well on the road. It looked a bit like an NSX had crashed into a 430 to me. And sure enough, the actual car still has a whiff of that about it, but it's not as bad as I thought it would be. It's a US product, isn't it? It's a car designed for the US federal market. It'll be incredibly cheap. It will definitely steal sales from the established mid-engine, you know, rivals at the moment. A Porsche Cayman will suddenly look very expensive, although don't underestimate the cachet of that brand. People that buy a Porsche buy it because they want a Porsche. They don't really, half of them or most of them don't care about how it drives.
Yeah.
But when it comes here, you know, to put a little bit of cold water on the fire, it's not going to come over here and be 55 grand. Because by the time they've messed around with it, done their currency exchange rates and put a bit of bit more margin on, added the VAT and everything else, I bet you it'll be 75 grand.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then at 75 grand, people will immediately go, well, look at the interior quality. Is that from a cow or is that from a, I don't know. And you start scrutinising things. I've got an American car at the moment. I've got that Camaro Z28 that I love. Yeah. In fact, it's going to end up being sold soon. It might even end up on a particular auction platform.
Oh, but, hello.
Because I've got too many cars to do the same thing. And even though I love that, that's probably the one that has to go. It struggles to stack up to most people. I love it, but a lot of people that would be in the market to spend that sort of money on a car would look at the interior and go, is this a joke?
That is true. That they are improving. I bought a GT350 when I was in the States a few years ago. And
you turned good money on that, didn't you?
No.
Every time I saw Edward or spoke to him at the end of the conversation, do you know anyone that wants a GT350?
Really nice one knocking around. Yeah.
I got carried away with that. Anyway, the build quality was pretty good.
Yeah, but it still doesn't have. There is a genius to the way these German manufacturers have managed to make interior an art form. The way that the materials they use, the way they put them together, the typefaces they use, even just the way the switches move is an art form. And the number of people they apply to those projects shows that it takes time. And the Americans,
Toyota do it quite, as well. Their Supra interior is very Germanic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There you go.
Very, but
So the Americans have said, why waste the money on that? We don't care so much about that. Our market, we'd rather sell a car that's a bit shonkier but cheaper. And I think it's a really great idea. So let's see with the Corvette. The Corvette is an institution. If you say Corvettes are bad, people don't like you. I know that because I once said the Z06 wasn't as quick as a GT2 back in the day, a 997 GT2. And I got death threats. Got proper death threats.
I had the same. I got vilified for a convertible Z06, whatever the latest one is.
Yeah.
I said it overheats and it's crap and it's boring. And
be careful.
Oh, my channel nearly got shut down.
This was in 2007, 2008, I would have thought. And back then there was a number you could call in America if you suspected someone might be about to commit a terrorism act. No word of a lie. And because I'm a swarthy chap that sometimes has a beard, someone clearly thought we'll dob him in just to get him in trouble. So because I don't, someone did.
Because you genuinely didn't.
So
like
I had a very long conversation at Houston Airport when I landed.
Wow.
So I think Corvettes are brilliant.
Yeah. No,
so the Corvette's an institution, and but I think moving to mid-engine platform is going to be interesting because it places greater demands on what the vehicle needs to be able to do. Because as a front-engined rear-wheel drive vehicle that had a transverse leaf spring, I mean, longitudinal leaf spring. You know, it's transverse, wasn't it, the leaf spring? Yeah. And it was crude. Therefore, you could offset a load of that through its personality. But now you're going to have a new generation of drivers that are going to have to understand mid-engine handling. Because if you back off mid-corner, it's not friendly. It's quite different. I'm sure it'll have the electronic suite that you need to control it. But it's a very... I hope it won't lose too much of its kind of
essence.
Brutal charm. because if it's mid-engine, it then has to become something that's accurate and precise. And that doesn't sit with the word Corvette to me.
And should it be called a Stingray? Do you think that was
I don't see the Stingray, the original Corvette, doesn't resonate so much for me. So for me, it doesn't matter so much. But whereas when Porsche resurrected this 718 name for the Cayman, I was just spitting on the floor going, sully your own heritage, you fuckwits. do you want to... can you hear that piano, can you?
You probably can, but
for the benefit of the audience, one of Edward's children is just lightly dancing across the ivories downstairs. It's a beautiful noise.
It's quite relaxing. It is. Yeah. Yeah, it's like being in a jazz.
I think
bar.
It's Eine kleine Nacht music. So I think the vet. It looks fine. It's going to be an absolute bargain, and it will shake things up. But cautionary note: it ain't going to be 50 grand, whatever it is, 60 grand when it comes here.
No, absolutely it won't. But it was more the positioning that they're going after, that big market that they can disrupt.
So, Sam, talk me through how this started for you. Why you became someone that wanted to make car content, and I will respectfully say that certainly when you started out, you made a decision to create car content. You didn't decide to become an influencer. And I'm sure that name has connotations for you. And now, in front of this slightly weirdly assembled kangaroo court, is your chance to explain.
Well, I have to say, the word influencer does make me feel a bit sick, because I don't think it means anything. I think, you know, what is it? But yeah, to go back to my story, I worked in PR, really. But for 8 years, I didn't go to university, just started working. I wanted to be a musician, didn't take enough of the white powder, so realized that wasn't going to work out for me. Switched to PR and had a great time of it. But my first love, my true love, is motorsport, really Formula One. And so throughout my PR career, I kept trying to, you know, win F1 clients, F1 sponsors, anything to do with F1, and it never happened. So quit the PR job and set up a consultancy. I quickly realized I didn't want to be a PR consultant, and I probably wasn't very good at it. So I was sitting around in an office not really knowing what to do, and went to my dad, who's been self-employed his whole life, and said, look, I'm frustrated, I'm bored, I want to go back and get a 9-to-5. And he said, no, find a hobby. And so when you're busy, put the hobby to the side, and when you're not busy, do the hobby and you'll be fine. And I always made home videos. I was that loser kid on family holidays being like, oh, mum, can you just walk through that tree again? You know, I was always making home videos. And as I say, I was passionate about motorsport and cars. I wouldn't say like I was like that knowledgeable, but I was really passionate. And my route to work, because I'm a plushy git, was from Clapham to Mayfair. And so I used to take the bus through Sloane Street. And at the time, I was following a lot of photographers on Instagram who were taking pictures of supercars on Sloane Street. And during the day when I did my commute, I'd see all these cars that they never saw. So I went, there you go, that's easy. Why don't I just make some videos as I walk to and from work, whatever cars I see, and I'll throw it up. And if I make 100 quid a month, brilliant. Maybe I can buy some tickets to the F1 or go to a Cars and Coffee or whatever it might be. And that was the sole purpose.
So, and at this point, I presume Shmi is already doing his thing at this point. There's already people out there putting videos up of people driving cars down a road.
For sure. So there was Shmi 150 and there were Supercars of London, who I would say were the only two people, the awful word, vlogging car life. So maybe not reviewing cars, not doing test drives. They weren't magazines. They were sort of showing...
Yeah, car paparazzi, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly that. So it was interesting. But actually, they weren't my inspiration at all. I was obsessed with motorbike vloggers.
Right.
So these guys who would ride around with a camera strapped to their helmet and just film what they saw and talk about it. And most of them were sort of lighthearted or comedic. It was never, they weren't like, oh, I've just bought this bike or this bike's got 400cc or whatever. They were just getting on with life and talking about it. And I thought, I could do something similar. I'm not going to try and be
funny. My favourite one of those is Baron von Grumble.
Baron von Grumble, hilarious.
I was supposed to do a video with him, Baron, if you're listening to this. And then I went and got this flipping job on the BBC and I never got back to him. We'll do it.
He's a super nice guy.
His one of going green laning in a GSXR is one of the... That's a great YouTube video.
But that's what I mean. He's just doing fun stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
On his bikes.
Or following that bloke with the polite thing on his back.
Oh, my God. You know those awful bikers who have they look like police.
But it actually says polite.
Yeah.
And so you think it's police.
He's following it going, look at this twat here.
He's abusing him. He's absolutely... And so him and Royal Jordanian's another great London-based guy who, again, doesn't even really talk, but...
They're all still doing it,
are they? They're all still doing it. Royal Jordanian, I think, is over 1 million subscribers now.
So you start doing this, and the parallel in what I was doing at the time was that I was engaged by Google, by YouTube, to create car content because YouTube felt that it could almost go after the linear television producers. And it was fairly apparent to me early on that we weren't going to get anywhere because it was costing us a good deal of money to make the content, even though we did it for nothing. But how are you supposed to compete with you standing there looking just with a camera on a street side if you can get 2/3 of the views or even the same views we could on a video that cost us £5,000 to make and you're doing it for £100? The game's over for me straight away.
I think yes, financially, but from as a fan or as a person who likes cars, the car content I was watching was you. I mean, was those Evo videos with Harry going to get the Pagani from the factory, and you know, it was the high quality, well curated.
Little did you know that you came in and ended it
and ruined it. Yeah. I screwed up what I was enjoying the most.
So you're doing that?
Yeah, doing that. Do it for a year alongside the PR. It becomes way too much fun. I go on a trip with Shmi, see that it can be a business, because he is a businessman. Whatever you might say about him, he's an incredible businessman. He's created this little empire for himself, which is definitely not little. And he's done it relatively all by himself. And so I saw that and I thought, that's mighty impressive. And I don't want to do PR anymore. I want to do this YouTube game. So I didn't pitch for any more business, ran out my contracts with my clients, and then I was a full-time YouTuber. And at that point, I think I'd earned about £1,000 from YouTube. So it felt like quite a big step. But I knew you could make money from having spent time with, you know, Shmi 150, Supercars of London. I knew it was possible. I just didn't know when it would happen.
So this is a very interesting subject for me. How do YouTubers / influencers monetize their lives? Because most people, I think, view it totally, you know, they're totally perplexed by it. Because they think, well, I've got a YouTube channel and I look at my analytics and I earn this per click.
Sure.
And their numbers, they'd have to be doing a billion views to afford the finance on one focus.
Yeah.
So how does it add up?
Yeah.
So how does it work then?
Firstly, it's very different to what it was just even 2 years ago. It's changing constantly. You do have to be getting millions and millions of views per month, correct. But the big focus now for YouTube is minutes watched. So you would have noticed about 3 years ago, YouTube, in my mind, from a brand perspective, when I used to work in PR, content was a minute long max. You know, it was all about short, clickable watch. You know, you just get as much information as possible. And then suddenly everyone started making 12, 15, 20 minute videos. And it was like, oh my God, like creating that is hard enough.
That was
watching
about the time
that
I sort of ducked out from it temporarily. I mean, I'll go back one day, but I remember that suddenly there was this push for minutes because we've been doing long videos already.
Okay. But who tells you this? Who
you figure it out.
No one tells you. There's no little tutorial back end of YouTube that you go to.
And do you know what? When we were fully, you know, when we were working with YouTube, we'd go in and say, tell us what to do, and they'd just shrug and go, there are no rules. We can tell you what we want to achieve with the platform, what our goals are for the next couple of years, and that we had to sign NDAs for that. But basically, they just said, you make up the rules, you know, you do what you want, and you can work it out. And you do work it out quite quickly. Minutes served became a really big thing.
So it became a massive thing.
And I can remember buying a camera. We had the first camera we used for YouTube was a Sony FS100, which is a bit of a revolutionary camera because you could bolt you know, proper kit lenses on the front of it, but the back end wasn't expensive as a Red. And this new one came out, I think Neil will confirm, I think it was an FS600.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And it did slow-mo. So first of all, slow-mo, people love seeing cars sliding around. But of course, it takes ages to deliver. So everything, I remember slow-mo added a third of the length onto the film. So I was like, Neil, wind up the
done,
slow-mo.
Perfect.
I'm going for that long right-hander. Fourth gear, there's a minute in that. And so you do become very cynical because you're just always thinking.
Yeah. And the magic number was 10 minutes. Yeah. That was the magic number. So basically, they pay you now on minutes watched. And, you know, I'd say 2 years ago, you could make a lot of money from not that many minutes watched. You know, if you were averaging 1.5 million or 2 million
so
views a month.
So when you say a lot of money, what do you think? So you've got, I'm not going to ask you what you earn from it, because I'll never do that. Sure. If someone asked me the same question, I wouldn't answer it. But I've seen you've got 430 something subscribers, 430,000 subscribers on your YouTube channel.
Sure, unbelievable.
And so what do you think's realistic? So if you put up a 10-minute video, what do you think is realistic to earn from a video like that?
A couple hundred quid.
Okay.
A couple hundred quid. And yeah. I think,
so
you know...
So you've got to produce a volume of content. And most important thing, and this is why... The big players in the area are doing well. It's your back catalogue.
That's exactly.
Because everyone's going back and looking at your back catalogue, and then the minutes accumulate.
Yeah.
That's exactly. I could take a month off and probably still earn some money. Not a lot, because your back catalogue doesn't earn you tons, but it earns enough.
People do lose interest in the old stuff very quickly. Don't
exactly.
They?
Which is, you think you've always got to have a view on that. You know, do you want views right now? Do you want the horrific clickbait of someone crashed into my car? Or do you want the what it's like to live with a Mulsanne?
Okay.
Because...
Oh, God.
Yeah.
for the avoidance of doubt, fucking expensive. That's the YouTube. So what about Instagram? What about the deals? I mean, I'm it's not my world, but I'm someone that's been going on car launches for, you know, a long time, 20 years, and the deal for me was they'd send you an invite, you turn up, you scrutinise the car, they don't always like what you've got to say, and then I used to sell the story wherever I could. And back in the day of syndication, I had a syndication manager, and we'd have a primary UK client, a primary US client, and then the rest of it was just around the world. If you could get it into the Bangladesh Evening Weasel for 20 quid, you did. Because if you could get 20 of those going, there was some bunts in it. But I never got, you know, if I'd turn around to Porsche and said, I'll come, but I want 10 grand to turn up, they would have, not only would they have laughed, they would have given me a sausage-shaped set of Vs and said, don't darken our door again. So, but now I hear that this is the way the world works. So tell me about how it should work.
Well, I, if that is the case, then I'm doing something wrong, and I'm losing a lot of money. But I mean, I personally, actually, no, that's a lie. I've been paid once by a manufacturer to attend an event, and I specifically had in the contract that I wasn't contractually obliged to review the car.
Right.
Because I don't think you can. If you're going to a launch or to review, you can't do a paid review. It's not right. I can't speak for my competitors.
You can't.
Yeah, I definitely can't speak for my competitors. I think it is a misconception that most YouTubers are paid to attend launches. I think most go because it's a free weekend, it's free content, it's nice to get in with the manufacturer.
I have a sense that that people in that space are incentivized to perpetuate the myth they are being paid.
Yes.
But why wouldn't you?
Well, they're not being paid, but it is paid for.
It's paid for
flights.
Yeah, but that's you know, you can't have a product launch.
That won't matter to you, but to a young guy on YouTube, not perhaps you, Sam, but someone who's not got a career yet, and they're like, well, come over, we'll pay for your flights and hotel, and all of a sudden I've got a career. They're sort of, oh, yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah, and I think as well that, yeah, there's that sort of, you know, association people go after. But I think, Chris, you're right, where I think the problem is now people ask for the money. I don't know if manufacturers are paying. I really don't. All of the commercial stuff that I do is from brands associated or attributed to the automotive world. And I can come back to that in a second. But I remember going on the Cullinan launch, and I know you were particularly influencer Cullinan launch.
I went on
attendance.
That is one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen in my life.
In all fairness, I would have gone with the location they shot it in.
Well, but I mean, it's leaving dinner, right? Because I think actually, hilariously, and Chris, don't punch me, but I think we were, as influencers, on the rotation before you, which I was shocked, but...
I obviously was mortified.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't realise at the time.
No, I mean, at that point, you know, there's question marks over the whole world. But anyway, I snuck away from dinner because I just wanted an early night and ended up by accident, I think, in the Phantom with a head of communications. I can't remember his name. Lovely chap. And we're in there and we're talking and we're having a relatively similar conversation. And he said, you know, how'd you find it? And he goes, you know, I had so many emails from people asking for money to attend this launch. And I went, oh, who? Just double checking my emails because I didn't want to.
I deleted that.
Yeah, exactly. And I was very, you know, at that point passionate about the fact that is quite ridiculous, because that event compared to most was crazy. We were in an Amman hotel overlooking this incredible valley. You could have massages. There was food everywhere. You went on this incredible.
None of which would influence your opinion of the Rolls Royce.
Absolutely
Royce
not. No one would
not,
ever say
not yours, Chris.
Look, I think this. this launch world, it's very easy for people of my generation and older to get crusty, a bit embittered, and get flecks of spit in their beards about it. But let's face it, this has always been a bit the wrong way around. You know, you've always been, for 40 years, car manufacturers have been inviting journalists to go and drive cars, putting them up in nice hotels, flying them at the front of the plane, giving them foie gras, and then saying, make up your own mind about the car. And do you know what? There's a lot of people who have been influenced by that. So maybe the word influencer has been going on a long time. They have been influenced by the way they were treated by car brands. And you know, the great George Bishop, who was a columnist in Car Magazine in the 70s and 80s, had a column called Carte Blanche, which was basically satirising this whole world. The idea was he'd go on car launches and just write about how good the food and the wine was. And at the very end, you should read them, they're wonderful.
Oh my God,
and at the very end, he'd go, and I drove the GLX, but I'd had so much Chateau Lafite, I can't remember what it was like to drive.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It's a bit pious to think that we haven't been through this process before. We have. But my problem is that there were always, within the liggers and the freeloaders that have always existed in any industry, there were some very honest voices. There were some people, you know, there were the Clarksons and the Steve Cropleys and the Gavin Greens and the people that I read as a kid who basically saw through the bullshit and could, with a straight face, say, do you know what, I don't mind sitting on the plane because when I get there, if it's crap, I'm going to say it's crap. And that's my background. And I feel that what's happened is it's just become a ligathon. You know, you turn up on the Cullinan launch, you get to ride a pony, you get to drive around Wyoming, and it's just expected. Before, you know, it's almost an unspoken contract that you're going to say the thing's wonderful. And I went on that event and I just thought, A, this is the most execrable vehicle I've ever seen in my life. I don't understand it. I think it's a bit shonky. Okay, it drives well, but the whole thing just stinks. And also, it was almost a metaphor for everything that's gone wrong with my industry. This, you know, come on a jolly, of course you're going to say it's great. Well, no, I'm not. I'm going to say it's bloody tasteless.
Well done for doing so.
But I think what I'm saying is I object to the way the industry has responded. I think I want to make it clear that I don't blame the influencer community completely. I do in some respects. I think some of the stuff they do is pretty difficult to swallow. But the car manufacturers have bought upon themselves. And it's understandable, isn't it? If you could say, let's bring the same old journalists we've been dealing with for 20, 30 years, the same outlets, with massively reducing audiences because they've not engaged with new media, and they might say it's shit, or a load of people that have got growing audiences, they're going to say it's great, where are you going to go? You're going to invite the ones that are going to say it's good.
That's exactly it. I don't think you can blame the manufacturers, but I am the few here, and I am naturally a little bit pessimistic and look at the influencer world with a bit of grimness. So I don't speak for the masses, but I really don't think we should have ever been invited on press launches. You know, I mean, of course, manufacturers are going to do it to get mass coverage, but it's just so the wrong place. If I'm really like a sort of, you know, up on the top of my pyramid looking down, I would call myself more of a content creator or a YouTuber or an Instagram or whatever. I cannot create what I want to create on a press launch. I can't bear it. I never claimed to be. I never wanted to be. I'm not an expert. I'm passionate about cars. I'm not an expert. I never trained to be a journalist. I didn't want to be a journalist. All I wanted to do was hang out with cars and show people what I was up to. Putting me on a press launch gives me anxiety because I don't know how to summarize a car in 15 minutes. I don't have the ability to do it.
I've been doing it a long time. I can't do it.
Okay.
But I know what you mean. But we're in one of those weird transitional periods where this industry and those departments are configured to hold events a certain way. And so what we're finding now, of course, is that all the influencers get taken, and it's a scrabble to see who can put the same Instagram video up in the same location with the same color bloody car before the other man.
Yeah, who's bought it?
But do you know what? That's again life repeating itself. Because 20 years ago, the equivalent of that was Autocar and Auto Express fighting to see who could get the spy shot of the new Mini and get it on their cover first. So the media does repeat itself. I think I can see why the world's gone that way. My great sadness is the loss of advocacy, because it looks to me like the repeat invites that go to influencers go because they're nice. I want to know how many of them would get invited back on the new Phantom launch if they said the Cullinan was shit. Because I'm pretty sure I won't be invited on the next Rolls-Royce launch. And I weirdly wear that as a badge of honour. But I think that at the moment, it's an easy win for the manufacturers. Because you know that, you know, Joe Bloggs, who's got 100,000 subscribers, isn't going to say the new Mercedes A35 is a bit daggy, which it isn't, by the way. Because because they're not going to get invited on the next one. So we're in this weird vortex of everything being brilliant. It's like that Fast Show sketch. Remember that bloke that used to walk around on the moors going, yeah, I saw this. It was just brilliant. It was amazing. And then I did this and it was amazing. Like, come on, guys. Something's got to be crap because it is. And recently on one of your pals' videos, someone sent me a link saying that I had my head up. I was noshing off McLaren or something. I mean, how can I be accused of that? I've gone to town on these buggers about the Senna. I think it's terrible. But I think the 600LT is...
Edward's grimacing, yeah.
Sold the Senna, yeah, Edward. But I really don't do that. And yeah. I think weirdly, it's the influencer community that's constantly saying, oh, it's great. Or, and this is my next subject I want to ask you about, should I buy a... The great unanswered question. So how do you deal with this?
Shall we have a short break?
Not just yet, let's get this one out of the way.
And then he's off.
Foaming at the mouth.
Because it's still raining and I want to have... No. So what's happened is, like anything, it's fascinating to observe the way the world's happened, because in the media, what happens normally is if something works, everyone joins in, and then you end up with quite a... What was a broad field of content narrows, because that's perceived as being the thing that works. And then you have almost template journalism. So now, the current template is amazing. I don't follow it that closely, but when I do go on, we've gone from a broad spectrum to, it's either I've got it first, or should I buy A, or it's I'm going to buy another one of these, therefore I've got an expanded car collection. And that's almost where it's at now. It's bizarre.
For sure. And I'll try and defend at least the UK automotive YouTubers as a group, because it's easy for me to sit here and try and distance myself from them. But I don't want to, because firstly, everyone's got their own business. Some of them are better at doing it than others. But the blame, I think, lies in that this formula that was created, which unfortunately still works.
Yeah, they get the numbers, don't they?
That's this year, I'm actively trying to step away from everything I've done previously, but also the little UK car
Why?
Scene.
Because you want to move on, or a sense of shame?
Both. Well, creatively, I'm stumped. And it's oversaturated. As you say, I couldn't do another year of I bought her, I wrapped her, I'm off to Monaco with her. You know, I couldn't do it. I mean, it's been done, and all that would happen is someone would upload the video a day before
I think
you
should do another we go to Monaco thing.
Yeah, hey, there go. But this is the thing. But I can laugh. It gets views.
I know,
that's
and I can laugh, because it's just the same as me going, I've gone sideways again in a supercar. Yeah. That we all have our own sort of personal memes that become ironic without us realising it. And I know that. I'm open to the same accusations.
And the
just
thing
so I happen
is,
to think that sideways supercar is more interesting than driving to cocking Monaco. but I might be in the minority there. Maybe the views prove that I am.
Well, that's the thing is, and maybe I'm a bad businessman, because the people, you know, who are growing quicker and getting great views are still doing what
so
I'm trying to separate myself from.
So talk me through this weird narcissism of having to buy ever more cars to maintain your audience's interest. Because if I extrapolate that out, where does that end? You just end up being a car dealer.
Well, Shmi's the one that you should have here instead of me, because I think he has...
No, I want your observations on it.
Yeah, I think... I mean, it's ridiculous if you ask me in that extent. If I had the money, would I be doing it? Potentially. Because why not? I've dreamed of owning cars my whole life, and if I was in a position...
What do you do with 20 new cars?
I don't know. I mean, I can barely... I have two at the moment. I have three. I can't even remember how many cars I got. And, you know, I live in a 99 Volvo V70. I have a Ferrari in storage that I never see, and I'm driving the world in a Porsche. It's already too many. And I've been very fortunate to be offered a couple of juicy bits this year, and I've just had to say no, because I don't need it. But there is a business out there in buying and selling cars for YouTube, because the spike you get from it, I think it's that living life vicariously. Because put me 5 years ago sitting in front of a desk all day, if Shmi or if anyone uploaded a video saying I just bought a new Vantage or I bought a thing, I'd be like, wow,
but the spike is the fact they're saying I'm buying it, not I've got one of these to use.
I care less about that I might buy or I've ordered. For me as a viewer, I want to see the collection process, the first drive, things
but
have gone
but
wrong.
But hold on, I get that. Yeah. But haven't we reached the stage where the specialness of that process has now been sullied? Because frankly, if you go, there's so many people picking up a new supercar every day on YouTube, the process isn't special anymore. In fact, I have to say, it's influenced me and made me think I might just step away from that world a bit, because it's happening every single day. And I think the car manufacturers need to be very careful, because if you are an honest punter that spent 5 years saving up for your first Ferrari, it's not going to feel quite special now, because every Tom, Dick and Harry's buying one every other day and videoing it. So there's that side. But also, is it, how does it how do you keep growing? Because it seems to me that the it's a nil-sum game. You just get into the point where you have to keep buying more cars.
Well, that's it. I think, and that's the trap you see some people falling into. And across the world, this is now not just the UK YouTubers. It's that they're falling into the trap. Once you start that, I'm buying, I'm selling. Are they,
it's like catnip.
You have to keep going.
Imagine if our old friend MC was an influencer. He would be a billionaire by now.
Yeah, but the thing is... But also, I worry about... I know you say it's a business, but let's face some facts here. We're about to enter into a few years of financial uncertainty, mm-hmm. and I fail to see how some of these cars are not going to end up being a lurking subprime, because I don't know how people buy these things, but you know, it's fanciful to think that everyone's buying them with cash. And if you're on the drip, as I know, because I've got plenty of bits and bobs on the drip, you can get the wrong way around very quickly. And it doesn't matter whether your YouTube channel's doing all right. If you lose £100,000 on one of your cars in 3-4 weeks because the world goes a bit wrong, that's a tricky situation. So I hope everyone's all right, because I worry that people could get themselves in a bit of a pickle.
I worry for sure. And I think finance made it too easy for people. And we did a bad job of selling finance to the masses, because suddenly we were these kind of kids out of nowhere buying these incredible cars. How are you doing it? Oh, finance. And people didn't understand what they were necessarily buying into, or that you only should sign a finance deal if you can afford the whole car.
I think, yes, that's a good point to make. And it's good of you to say that. I think that group does bear a bit of a moral responsibility, but I've done it as well. In my own way, I've encouraged people to go out and buy cars they probably couldn't afford. I didn't realize I was doing that, and I apologize for it at the time. However, the number of young lads and ladies you see driving around in a new M4 on the tick, that it turns out, you look at them, you think, oh, they're doing well. They still live with mum and dad. Yeah. How's that work? So basically, a lot of this is underwritten by really kind parents who let them live at home so they can spend what would go on rent or a mortgage throwing money at finance.
And I think this is a social media issue in general with the world, because nowadays we're always competing to be better versions of ourselves, to try and live up with the damn Blazarians or whoever it might be. And even people watching you on Top Gear or whatever it might be, or Ed with the cars that you're trading, they might think, oh, he owns this or he has that. People want more. I met a young kid the other day who's driving around in I couldn't even tell you what, something completely ordinary and standard. And he goes, oh, I'm thinking about buying a 4C. And I went, why? He goes, oh, you know, I want a cool car, and they're like 35 grand, and I could get the finance. And I was like, what? Just stop. Yeah. You do not need a 4C. It will ruin your life, and it's going to cost you a ton of money for what? So you can post on Instagram that you've got a 4C.
My view is, let them go into it eyes open. Tell them it'll be a disaster, but say to them, give it a go, because it might be something you can do something with. But I think the bete noire for me is the should I buy it? Because the answer to that question has to be, I don't care.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I don't. So either buy it or don't buy it, and by all means make a video about it. But why are you asking me?
So I'll tell you what. So today I've literally just put a video live now with the Project 8. And I was going back and forth in titles.
You didn't.
No, but I'm very bad.
If you did, you would. There's a large window.
No, he changed it just as he came upstairs, I think.
But it's nearly as bad, because I'm bad at titles and thumbnails. So I just put, I got a Project 8. Now that is click.
And do you know, it is. And do you know what? Certainly in the old days at Autocar, if you'd been working with Andrew Frankel, get was considered to be the laziest verb of all. So if I put get or got, Andrew would red pen it, circle it, and go find other verb.
It's almost, it's bad writing in every sense.
Yeah.
But the problem with the world is that sitting there, if I put, you know, Jaguar lend me Project 8, people go...
So technically also, it's incorrect, because you haven't got it.
Well, I've got it for a week.
Oh, Jesus, we're deep diving semantics here.
No, I agree. And it doesn't sit well with me. But this year, everything I've been doing, I have learned that, unfortunately, as much as I can try and distance myself, as much as I can try and do something else, the audience still want what works. And what works is clickbait on YouTube. Like, really brutal, aggressive clickbait.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, buying and selling cars and doing stupid stuff, going to McDonald's.
But before we just take a break, I think the numbers are tailing off a bit for
it. Agreed.
I think that community needs to think about what the next thing is quite quickly, which is what you're doing. We'll talk about that after the break. But no, it's fascinating to hear it from your perspective. I mean, a lot of people you know, think that I sort of mutter about this under my breath. I don't. You know, I'm far too busy trying to mess my own life up, frankly. And actually, I have a real curiosity for that world because I can't do it, and I have a respect for it. I think the content marketplace is a meritocracy. It's the one thing you can say about it. I think there's another side to it I'd like to touch on when we come back after the break. But I do think that if you make content and people watch it, then there's something in that because you're not paying to drive that traffic to your YouTube channel. You can buy followers on Instagram. That's a right old bloody snake pit, that is. I didn't realise how bad that was. Mm. But you can't buy them on Twitter. Well, you could, but not so easy now. But the YouTube area is a free playing field. And if you do something and it gets views, then frankly, you're standing on your own 2 feet. And any number of people can say, that's shit, it's shit content. It doesn't matter. It doesn't. If people are watching it, it's still content. I think Love Island's a bit whiffy.
Oh,
But it just that so happens it's not for me. Yeah. But more loads of people watch it, so it's a successful format. And I think I apply that to the influencer area. There are some people in that area that don't do very big numbers and still there, and I don't really understand how that works. Maybe you can enlighten me on that afterwards.
Yeah, well, to leave it on a cliffhanger before the break, I will say you can actually buy views still on YouTube.
Can you?
But you can't buy engagement. But we'll save that for after the
okay. Well, look, so that's at Seen Through Glass, at Edward Lovett, and at Harris Monkey. We're going to go and have a comfort break, and I'm going to try and understand how Sam has persuaded me that he's got a Project 8.
Collecting Cars, the safe, smart, and simple way to buy and sell collectible cars. An online auction platform for the UK and Europe. Follow us on Instagram at Collecting Cars and also collectingcars.com.
The collectingcars.com podcast with Chris Harris and Edward Lovett.
Welcome back to part two of the Collecting Cars podcast here with Edward Lovett, still at Edward Lovett, and Sam from Seen Through Glass at Seen Through Glass on every single platform imaginable, including YouTube. So let's just digress from the specifics of YouTube and how it works and how people make videos and what is clickbait and what's not. Your project, this frankly enormous project you've undertaken, basically to drive around the world in a 911.
Yeah, bit off more than I could chew there. It was a very romantic idea to begin with. And actually, the idea was born through a mutual friend of ours, Philip Kay. During Monterey Car Week about 2 years ago, and we were driving on one of those, you know, rallies that happens during that week, and we looked at each other and said, how cool would it be just to go around the world in a cool car, just attending all these different kinds of events and having a great time, and it ticked something in my head. And at that point I was already feeling a little bit stifled by the sort of YouTube in general and the UK car scene, so I was looking for something different. I realized that it's quite hard to plan a round the world trip in 2 months. So I delayed it for a year, convinced my girlfriend to give up her life and come with me, and started plotting and planning. So yeah, it's not quite as dramatic as driving a 911 across the world, because I'm too white middle class and I think I would have got beaten up in somewhere dodgy. So the 911 did Australia. It's done Europe. It's getting some TLC at the moment. It's about to go to America.
Is it all in one piece still? Is it proved reliable?
Unbelievable. Tank. I mean, I could not tell. Like, we keep talking about it. There's not a better car to have done it in.
Yeah.
For what I do, it works perfectly on like Instagram and YouTube thumbnails. It's, you know, looks kind of wacky. Like, wow, he's doing it in a 911. Couldn't be more comfortable. Couldn't be more reliable. Super practical. It's got no rear seats, so we can fit so much in it.
Yeah.
Quick when we need it to be quick. Okay, fine. It's the dodgy turbo engine, but I actually like it. It's great for fuel economy. We've got a roof box on there as well, which is practical and also styling wise. It just works. And I would have ruined everyone's life with my back and forth on what to take. RS4, Bentley Continental. I mean, just so many different decisions. And finally sending on the 911, I'm so pleased because it's been
so solid. So it's interesting on many levels for this, for me, because I come back to the content. One of the other problems with, I think, the influencer scene is that they've inadvertently sided themselves into basically new exotica, because that's what's available on finance and that's what you get invited on for launches. And one of the great editorial issues of all time has always been taking the line of least resistance. So if you're sitting there and this has been the same for car magazines forever and latterly now videos. If you're sitting there planning to go and do something expansive and interesting and you look how much it costs and how long it takes to organise it, and just as you're about to commit to it and a bit worried about whether you can do it, someone phones you and says, do you want to come on the whatever launch? You go, oh, I'll do that because I could get just as many views for half the kick. But you've gone out there and done something different, which is admirable. But has it worked in terms of engagement? Because the fact is, you probably could have grown your channel faster if you just plied the same old trade, couldn't you?
For sure. I definitely would be getting more views, probably more subscribers, if I just stuck at it. Because I think if you look, there are other people in the scene doing a better job in terms of views, at least. But the few things that I'll say is, firstly, creatively, I'm far more incentivized. I think it's added... I feel more proud of the content I'm creating. That's one thing. I think before, if I met a friend who's not in YouTube, said, oh, let me watch one of your videos, I was just like, I don't think you should want to. Whilst now I would point to any of the videos I've made this year and say, yeah, look, check it out, see what you think. It's a bit car-y, but, you know. And so I'm pleased with that. And it's opened the door to a lot of opportunities which I think wouldn't have been there if I hadn't repositioned myself. But I still make mistakes of anything. You chase the views, you chase the engagement. And so, you know, when somebody comes along and offers you a 1936 Alpha something, I still have to go, well, have you got a Lamborghini Huracan there as well? Because unfortunately the Alpha's just not going to get the clicks or views. Yeah. Sometimes I don't care and I think, screw it, I just want to make this video because I want to make it. Sometimes it works out, but the majority of the time you've got to think with a business head on and you've got to make these slightly grim decisions. Because somebody told me recently, another guy on Instagram, McDonald's sell to the masses, it doesn't have to taste great. We all sit there, we all know McDonald's is made of crap and stuff like that, but they sell millions.
Yeah, we had a great conversation over a few beers not long ago about, what if you had to just make the clickbait video, would it be? It would be a kind of a drag race with someone from Love Island topless in the back.
You're so right.
And it would have a Lamborghini and a fettuccine and something else.
And something they just bought.
Yeah.
I just bought my LaFerrari and I raced it again.
Should I buy a whatever and drag race it with someone in the buff in the back?
Done. You figured it out right away. You should buy my YouTube
channel. Again, these formats. I think the other thing I want to say about YouTube, because I've had this accusation laid at me. I've had a privileged start in life. I went to a nice school and I'm very lucky. But it does seem that the one thing that binds all YouTubers in the car scene together is that they probably started out with more resources than the ordinary man in the street. And I think everyone will struggle to shrug that one off. And I just wish more people in that space put their hands up and went, I had a good start in life. Because it seems there's a whole load of, yeah, I did this on my own and I built this. Oh, come on. Just I have to fess up in interviews for the BBC. People say, where did you go to school? And I have to, I say, well, I went to a boarding school.
Sure.
I'm very lucky. But it seems that there's a whole load of, you can do this on your own if you just get a YouTube channel. And I think that's bullshit.
Yeah, and I think, and again, speaking from my own personal experience, I'm the same. I had a very, very nice upbringing, went to boarding school, had a lot of support from my parents. I think if I ever asked my dad to buy me a car, he'd punch me in the face and tell me what's what. But I have that confidence that if everything goes tits up, I've got a very nice home to run back to.
Yeah.
And I will fly the flag for somebody else. Supercars of London, Paul Wallace, is the one genuine guy who really didn't come from any background of anything.
Yeah, that's fair enough, yeah.
And, he built it as an empire from university and has been rocking it by himself. I think it's easy to see with all the others that there's that support, whether it's financial support, emotional support, or physical support. Because as I say, whilst I would love my dad to handle my finance payments, he doesn't. But I know if I make a really bad decision, I'm not going to be living on the street. I'm going to be living in a very nice house with my parents, which is a very nice life to live. So that is support in itself.
I don't think anyone should feel guilty about that. I suppose it's the lack of transparency at times.
100%.
Because you're selling a dream to young people. And frankly, it's not attainable unless you get a big leg up in life. That's like the He-Man moral message at the end of children. So let's just shift away from that for a minute. In the news yesterday, this awful incident at a car meeting where a couple of cars have collided and gone into a crowd. As we record this, we don't know whether there's been a fatality. So out of respect for those that have been affected, first of all, I want to say commiserations and just so sorry for the hurt and pain that you must be going through. But it's a subject I think we need to discuss, because when I read the news, my immediate reaction was it was just going to happen. These things are by their very nature unregulated, and some people just just grow horns at the wrong time. And, you know, speed doesn't kill, but the inappropriate use of it does. And this is just bad news for all of us, because we're all part of a broader community and we have responsibility within that community. And I know that I can't be holier than thou, because there's images of me when I was younger going sideways and stuff. But I have to distance myself from this. And I just cannot, I can't believe this has happened. I can't. Yeah.
This was a cars and coffee sort of car meet.
It was a car meet. It was for a charity. You know, it was a static event, and it was people leaving the event.
But we've had a lot of this recently.
Where people, you know, a caffeine in machine.
Yeah.
You know, they have a sign, don't they, that says, "Don't be a dick when you leave," which is absolutely right, because a lot of people can't drive these things very well, and 600 horsepower, when you give it a bootful, can surprise you. And if you want to show off and do the 80-yard power slide, you've got to be qualified to do it. Crikey, I do it on a daily basis. I'm not sure I'd want to do it in front of a crowd of people, because I'd be unsure of getting it wrong.
Well, I think, you know, the one thing that shocks me is Sloane Street culture. And I have no idea if Ed, maybe you've experienced this a bit, being more London-based recently, is that the way that Sloane Street has evolved over the last 5 years is mad. And I myself and a lot of us on social media are to blame for this. And I put my hands up because we had no idea what we were creating. But, you know, I've grown up in London, grew up in that area. Sloane Street was a nothing street. It was a cut through to Knightsbridge or Mayfair or whatever. And suddenly, you know, it started to sort of be a place where you could see nice cars. So myself, Shmi 150, Alex Penfold, all these different people would click that that's where you could see nice cars and you'd hang out. And as I say, I would make videos where people would drive past in a F12 slowly or quietly and I'd go, "Oh, boring," because I wanted to hear revs or something like that. And I was naive and I didn't know what I was doing. And people were watching this and going, "Oh, I might go to Sloane Street next weekend. It looks really cool." And it got to a point where now in the summer, it's like going to Goodwood Festival of Speed. There are hundreds and hundreds, and it's not kids, it's people, you know, boys, girls, dads, uncles, aunts, lining the streets with cameras and phones and stuff. And if you're driving down that street and you're inexperienced or you're young, the temptation to floor it with all those cameras, it's really hard to ignore. Everyone's like, rev it, and you're in some amazing car, which you want to show off anyway, because why else are you driving on Sloane Street? Is hard. And so that, I think, is an accident waiting to happen. I think these kind of weird, unfortunate incidents that happen at car meets or late at night, they've happened forever. If you look at, what was that Koenigsegg, that awful Koenigsegg crash at a big car meet, I can't remember where, quite a few years ago now.
You said they've happened forever, but this idea of almost the impromptu car meet that just evolves on a road is quite a recent phenomenon. And it's a bit like the rave culture of the 90s, where, you know, word would get round, it's that field, you'd go out there and do your thing. But the problem is that there are inherent dangers here, and it's oil and water. You've got two things that don't mix. You've got civilians walking around in an urban area and people attempting to demonstrate very high performance cars. Now, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to work out those two things just shouldn't be in the same place.
You say it's happened forever. It probably has happened in some form, but what is different now is when someone's pulling out of caffeine and machine, that there's 100 people stood there with a mobile phone filming it, sort of egging on. And you sort of leave, and I'm going to be sensible now, and you can't help yourself. You know, these guys can't help themselves. You know, and I've made mistakes in my life. I could count them on about 10 people's hands.
We laugh. But it's now getting serious.
And I
made an arch comment on Twitter not long ago about this, and I you know, and your pal Yanni, who wasn't happy with me, but I stand by what I said. I just don't think. I think there's a place to go fast, and I love speed. You know, I've made a living out of it, and I'm it's my addiction. I love fast cars, but I just don't think a town is the right place to be doing it.
Well, to touch on that specific instance, so this was a Huracan Performante leaving a car show, attempting a launch control. He lost control and ploughed into a lamppost.
It was just by the grace of God that there wasn't someone by that tree.
Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned that a few social media people leapt to his defense, which I think was wrong, and I would tell them they're wrong. They're all good friends of mine, but I would tell them they're wrong. But I think he would never have done that launch control if people weren't filming it. Because why would you? Who leaves a car park and goes, "Oh, I'll just do a launch control and traffic"?
Well, exactly, but you can't offset the blame on the person, the people with the camera.
No, but I think
I myself and others have created this culture of let's show off. I want to have a viral video. I want my car to get loads of views and hits. And we ourselves are to blame for that in some part. I don't think we knew the beast that we were creating.
Okay, and that's fair enough, and good of you to say it.
I had a question with that performante. Would his insurance company pay out?
There was a big question. I don't know what happened because it did go viral. It was on the Mail Online and everything.
Driving without due care and attention.
I don't wish any ill on the individual. And I'm sure he feels sore about the whole incident.
Oh yeah, and he's ridden off his. Well, he's not ridden off his car.
I think we've got to be very careful about how about what we encourage people to do and the way that we're persuading them to interact with their cars. It's gone a bit wrong, and yeah. I think this incident is gonna. It's going to create a change.
It's going to shake it up.
I wouldn't be surprised if it causes some emergency legislation. If they ban meetings of cars, public meetings of cars, mm-hmm. because ultimately something that weighs 1.5 tons traveling at 60 miles an hour is more dangerous than a gun.
For sure.
You have a responsibility when you own one to not do that. I'm so sad that it's happened mm-hmm. because it will affect. The wider community. Well, you can't create legislation that just targets the one bit that you think is wrong. It'll have to be something more blanket that will affect us.
Of course. And then, obviously anyone that's been affected in any way, it's awful and it's horrific. But the guy responsible in certain elements, if he lost control or whatever the circumstances, has now got that guilt on his conscience as well for whether he's got any injuries himself or has caused injuries. From trying to simply show off or trying to simply entertain, for the wrong reasons, has ended up in a horrible position.
Let's hope that that it sorts itself out. So, where do you want to go with all this? What's your
home?
Sleep. You've got the round the world thing mm. ticking along nicely. Mm-hmm. And
where are you off to next with that?
So America is really the next big behemoth. So the car flies, unbelievably flies, thanks to car shipping. There's my plug for them. At the end of this month, and then we're 4 months zigzagging across America, west to east coast.
How many miles has it done now?
It's done 19,000, which is less than I thought.
Yeah.
Luckily bought it with only about 500 miles on the clock. But I thought we were going to be at like 25 by now. So I think by the end of the year we'll be under 50, which I'll be very happy with. All dependent on whether we get it to the Middle East or not. So,
and do you share your American trip before you go, so people know where?
Yes. So the route has been unveiled on
Sam
my Instagram.
Fame.
Yeah. the route has been unveiled. It is subject to change because it's just too terrifying trying to plan.
Where do you stand on the cult of personality with this? Because of the way that YouTube works, and people don't want to go by their given Christian name or surname, that you create a name. You're Seen Through Glass, and there's Cities of London, and there's a Shmi, and there's lots of others. But it can come across, it's a bit Mugabe-like, wherever you go in, whenever you used to go around Zimbabwe, there was always a picture of Big Rob, and everything had his name on it. And everyone's now, when I think you have to question your existence when you're walking around with a fleece with your own name on it. It's a slightly odd thing to do.
Hey, I only ever wear a cap with STG on it. My own branding, my own cap, which isn't even for sale anywhere. Just to remind people, hey, you can...
Is it just in case you forget your own name?
Probably. It doesn't even say Seen Through Glass. It just says STG, so it's a really bad design. But
which is a bit close to STD, isn't it?
I think you could say so. But I don't know. It's so that whole recognisability, I mean, yes, you could call it a new age of fame, is so bizarre. I think it's great to meet people. It never fails to shock me. We drove 4 days across the desert in Southwest Australia, pull into some godforsaken red dirt town, and a guy is following us the whole way, and he jumps out and he goes, "Seen Through Glass!" And I'm like, no, it's just not possible. And that continues to blow my mind that people even want to say hi. Great that they want to watch the videos. Why do you want to come take a picture with me? All of that is weird. But that's just the way the world is, isn't it?
It's because you're a handsome beast.
Well, honestly, I'm getting a hair transplant next week.
Because you're a well-spoken individual. Do you think that limits your appeal or do you think it helps?
I think originally there was a lot of, posh boy, posh boy, posh boy. I think a few of the others had broken down some of those walls already, as you touched on. There's kind of this general consensus that we all come from a nice upbringing. I actually think it helps me abroad. Yeah. So I think luckily being well spoken, increases my appeal in other countries because I think people find me relatively easy to understand, even though I mumble a lot of the time. Who knows? And who knows where it goes? I think the big twist we're going to see, the big change is, I think credibility has to come back to social media. I think at the minute that's what's going out the door every day is credibility.
And so. Do you think that we're going to move back to the point where advocacy matters, where people have to trust what you do?
100%, because aren't we all sick of people selling teeth whitening kits and, you know, slimming juices?
No, mate, my pegs are pretty yellow.
Yeah.
Can you point me in that direction?
Maybe I'm following
also,
the right...
Also, the old hair loss thing, all three of us definitely could do with that.
And I can tell you a few accounts to follow for that.
That's going
to
be our next sponsor.
Please, I'll be back for that episode. So I think it has to be because now there's too much... You just don't believe in what you're following or watching. You enjoy it. And, you know, it's opinion forms. Like, that's why I don't like the word influencer. I was at an event recently with BMW and Jody Kidd was there. And we were stood next to each other. And the speaker goes, "Don't worry, you'll have plenty of time to catch stuff for your social medias." Mm. And she looked at me and she goes, "What does that even mean?" And I said, "I don't know, because she's the only person here with actual influence, you know." I think we have opinions. People enjoy watching us and sharing some of those opinions. But do we have real influence? I don't think so, because... Chris, if you say an F12 is good, people are going to say it's good. If I say an F12 is good, they're going to say Sam likes the F12.
Well, I slightly disagree with that. I've always felt that I have to resort to the word influence. I can vaguely influence an opinion, but most people have already made up their mind. So in my experience, people have made up their mind the car they want. Mm. And what I say might just affirm what they think. But if they've already made up their mind they're going to buy it, and I say it's crap, they'll probably just go, "Well, Monkey's got this one wrong. I wanted it anyway."
I'm not sure I totally agree with that. However, unfortunately, that a lot of the cars that you review today, going back to your word, unattainable. Sorry, but if you want to buy a 911R, and you say it's a great car, you can't go and buy one. You can go and buy a used one now, but you can't, you know, a lot of these new cars, you can't go and order.
Which is why I think that I bought her, I'm living with, still works, because I think there is that element of...
So much of it, they're not living with it. All you do is you get to learn what it's like to see someone collect it from a showroom or work out what spec it's going to have. Well, I couldn't give a monkey's whether you're going to have, you know, whales foreskin leather on the seat.
God, that'd be a great option.
Just makes no bloody difference to me. But if you told me, this is why the Americans tend to be better at this stuff, because they actually go and use the cars.
Yeah.
Whereas now I want to know whether, you know, if I was going to do track days, but mostly road driving, could you save money and not buy a 911 Touring and have a 911 T like you've got? You're much closer to answering that question because you're doing miles on it. But most of the people that are buying the cars, they're not actually telling me what it's like about the car to live with. It just gets driven around bloody central London.
I think that's changed. I mean, Schmies has taken his Ford GT off to America to do trips. And
becoming more expensive.
Obviously more expensive and also sort of unattainable.
No, more expansive, not expensive. So we are beginning to learn what it's like to live with the cars. But for a while, a lot of the content was based around the moment of transaction.
Agreed.
Or the moment of collection.
For sure.
But I think the other aspect I'm cyclical with my car enthusiasm. Sometimes I like new cars, but I tend to then go off those and I start to I enjoy old cars. And I think there's a whole world of fascinating content that the influencer communities has to avoid, mm-hmm. because you can't buy it on the Never Never, and because you don't get to be seen in a hypercar the whole time. So, you know, I would far rather read someone's journey into buying an E90 M3 that's done 50,000 miles and has got slightly worn piston rings. I want to know about that, but I don't, because so few people are doing it, because it's, you don't get the clickbait, you don't get the numbers, and the numbers won't stack up. So we're just stuck with, I've bought another brand new warranted car on the manufacturer scheme.
You probably don't want to be stuck in the Australian desert with that.
No,
E92.
This is the funny thing. I bought this 99 Volvo in the summer, and it was a 900-pound car, and I made three videos with it on the trot, all got in crazy engagement. I was like, this is amazing, this is my whole new channel, I'm going to reinvent myself. And then when I announced Drive the World, everyone said, take the Volvo. And I was like, no.
damn. So she got written off this morning.
Yeah, there's literally limitations to it. But I think... Okay, another bone I have to pick with you on that, because I agree there's a whole area that's untouched by YouTube, even from like 60s to like mid 90s. I think it's just untouched. And you recently said that why would anyone buy a Challenge Stradale over a 430 Scuderia? But Challenge Stradale is my all-time dream car, and I will defend it until I'm falling off a cliff.
I'm so old, I went on the launch of that.
Oh my God, that would have been my dream.
Do you know what? I've still got... The Ferrari will often give you a little gift, and the gift was a long-sleeved T-shirt with Challenge Stradale written on
How
it.
How much do you want for it? Can you put it on collecting cards?
It's unusable now because it's my strimming shirt. I've always used it because it's got long sleeves.
It's so upsetting.
When you use the brush cutter, you don't get stung by the stingers.
I have a Challenge Stradale umbrella.
Do you?
That's how obsessed
Look, and
I
I've
am.
Got, I've also, I went on the 430 Scuderia launch, and okay. I've still, there's a jacket for that as well.
A black one. I've got it.
Did I give it to you?
No, I've got one as
have
well.
Have you? Yeah. So,
but I think that's a whole area, that and before, which could
by the way, you're completely wrong. If you did the Pepsi Challenge and drove them back to back, the Challenge Stradale feels like an air pump. It's got
no
power.
But it doesn't matter. It's character, Chris. It's character.
It's not. It's just bloody noise. Just drill a hole in the 430's exhaust. You've got the same effect. It's not. Again, these are not sophisticated differences.
But do you not think the 430 is already a step towards being too quick?
No, I think the 430 might be the last of the ones that still feels a bit ragged because its gearbox actually works.
It works. I agree, but there's something about the Challenge Stradale where you can thrash it and you're not at that scary death-defying speed,
but you're still going
you're still going quick enough
to offend the population.
Yeah. I know what you're saying, Sam, but I think the 430, Chris is right. It's a sweet spot, two against one, mate.
You need to construct a better argument than the sense of the beginning. There's something about
it's a personal story.
But what you've done there is that's your poster car, you see.
Yeah.
And we're all, that's one thing, and none of us should ever leave. If it's a poster car, you don't need to justify it more than that. I own cars purely because I wanted them when I was younger. And I've got a shed full of rubbish like that, and I don't justify them to anyone. People say, why have you got a 512 TR? And I just say, because I wanted one. I don't have to justify it to you. Objectively, it's hopeless. but it's the thing I had on my wall when I was doing my A-levels, and when I was busy failing everything, I looked at it and thought, one day I've got to have one of those. And that is the only reason any of us should need to own a car. And it's also what I want to see from your community. I don't want to read... I've got another bloody AMG on order, or whatever it is, or another Ferrari, new Ferrari. I want someone to come out and give me a passionate explanation as to why they bought an E60 M5 that might blow up at any point.
Yeah.
Because they once heard one fizz past them on a dual carriageway.
Sure.
But I'm not seeing that because it doesn't fit with the business model as it stands.
Yeah, I mean, to tie back again, bought this manual 360 whenever that was, a year and a half ago now, and I just made a video with it this week and put it out, part of Drive the World. The amount of comments I got, oh yeah, Drive the World's been crap, so good to see you back making good passionate content. I'm like, this is part of that,
one part of content creation that you have to live with. You know, I've just been beasted for years about Top Gear. You know, you sit with professional people, you make, I think, some lovely films, and all you get is, well, these are just not very good. And then you sit down with this moron here with a microphone and sit there and talk rubbish for an hour, and everyone goes, oh, a podcast is amazing.
It's brilliant.
He's like, oh, come on. Don't do this to me.
Am I allowed to ask you how you're finding Top Gear? Is that contractually...
No, I'm obviously pleased that this latest one's been well received. I don't talk about it too much beyond that.
It feels like it's over before it started. We're about
to start a new load now, so it's a split run, they call it. There's more that have been commissioned. Look, I knew it was going to be a poison chalice when I took it on. I quite like a challenge.
Sure.
You've got to sit through it. And also, you'll understand it because I had done what you're doing and I'd got what I could from YouTube. I was going nowhere. It had stagnated for me. I couldn't make any more money out of it. I didn't make much money out of it. The deal with Google was up, so I had to start doing it on my own. And I very quickly realized that the only way I was going to make money was to fall into these silos, to fall into these little vertical niches of the template videos, and I'm not interested in those. I have a curiosity and an interest in cars that's much broader than that, and I would have found it very stifling. I couldn't just go and do drag races. Should I buy a? I would go mad. I'd have to go and get another job, and I didn't want to. So when someone said, "Do you want to go and make a TV show?" I was like, "Well, it's not really what I want to do, but it's an opportunity to go and make content that's funded properly, and there is a business model behind it. I struggled with YouTube because, if I was trying to make beautiful videos that were 15 minutes long and cost, minimum $5,000 to make, and frankly, in TV terms, that's catering budget, it was never going to work. So I had to give it a go. I still have a presence on YouTube, and we still put stuff out there, and I'm pretty proud. When we do the right cars, they still do good numbers.
No, I think it's pretty much.
Sure.
But I, like, as you're doing, like, it's interesting talking to you because you're clearly at that point now where you're, that's why I said, where do you want to end up then? Yeah, do you want a TV show? Do you want to carry on bossing the space you're in?
No, I don't think I want TV. I find it too creatively I don't like it. I've done a few bits of like presenting stuff and it's not personally for me. I want to be more involved in the actual.
Well, everyone that's started out on their own gets used to being in control. And
for
sure. I've had to cede control. I mean, I still have a big input into what we feature and how we do it. But ultimately, I have a creative lead and I'm not the creative lead. And that's that can be very frustrating for me because I came from a world where I woke up and went, Nilo, we're doing this.
Sure.
And it's just so liberating.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is frustrating. But I tell you, without being patronising, go and try it because it's quite a good lesson of discipline to have someone else tell you what to do.
Yeah, I worry with my control freak nature that I would struggle. But for sure, I mean, it's if the opportunity presented itself to do anything cool and fun. For me, it's F1. I mean, I think that's where I'm trying to reposition and angle myself. In what way, I don't know. And I've met some amazing people in doing YouTube. And so I think opportunities that are starting to present themselves, from... dealerships to consignment to helping brands with their social media to advising to consulting. I enjoy that. I really enjoy looking at the social media landscape, trying to read it, trying to advise. I still think so many companies, especially within automotive, get it so wrong.
Yeah.
Who says that I'm the person to tell them how to do it right? But I would be.
No, well, the problem is you're talking to car dealers that have been car dealers forever. They're not.
They're not awake to it. They're not necessarily aware of it. So. Who knows, but I'm definitely I'm angling for the next thing, as I think you've said that you were doing. I've realized it's at that point that I definitely don't want to give it up.
Yeah,
but it's time to
maintain a presence there but then use it as a stepping stone. Right, I'm gonna have to call time on that. It's been really interesting. Best of luck with it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Sam.
I'll keep listening. It helps my 8-hour drives.
We look forward to getting the 991 on collecting cars after your round the world trip.
He's unstoppable, the car trader. So that was the Collecting Cars podcast with me, Chris Harris, at Harris Monkey, him at Edward Lovett, and Sam at Seen Through Glass, and we'll see you again at some point.
Thank you very much.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.